I want to tell you something about my name tag, but please don't tell the Urbana authorities about it. This is probably Exhibit A, one of the hardest earned name tags at Urbana. Let me tell you the story of this poor name tag. They have a special registration for speakers, so we don't have to stand in these long lines. So I went on Saturday, and they said, oh, we're very sorry, your name tag came, but it was misspelled, and we've sent it back. So at the end of Saturday, I went back, and they said, well, it did come back, but it was still misspelled, and we've sent it back again. So on Sunday, we asked about the name tag. They said, finally, we have a correctly made name tag. It's somewhere in this complex. So Sunday, with my helpful assistant, Chloe, we started looking for the needle in the haystack, my name tag, my correctly spelled name tag, in this enormous place. And we must have walked several miles, and in every office they were saying, it does exist. But I was sure it was in the Urbana name tag black hole and lost. Well, finally, a very ingenious lady at one of the places says, why don't you stop looking for it and we'll make you up another one? Hey presto, right there. I was very relieved because I'd been walking for about an hour. So she made me up the name tag, but the problem is her equipment didn't have all these fine, fancy stickers and labels that allow me to come backstage and come up here. And so we had to scurry around and find people to get me all these things. It took ages. And I went home, and in the evening listened to the very interesting evening and spoke to you, and then heard about the announcements that everybody here had to be tagged and had to wear one of these things on their arms. Brothers and sisters, I'm a free Egyptian. They forgot to tag me. It's great to be here. I was with my wife, Rebecca, who's sitting down here. We were both at Urbana 84, but didn't know it. I mean, we knew we were here. But we didn't know we were both here because we didn't know each other. 64. That's probably before your parents were born. Urbana, 64. We were both here. She was a freshman at Oakland University, Michigan, and I was a second-year student. Hey, I was a second-year student at McGill University in Montreal. So there's hope for you guys. There may be someone here whom you will not meet. I did not meet her. But in 67, we were back here, and we were engaged. So God does miracles. And we've been married for 41 years. Can you believe it? One of the advantages of sharing with you from a long-term perspective is that we can see what God has done. We shared about the garbage village yesterday, and what's written in the bullet in the handbook is wrong. I have nothing to do with the garbage village. We did not go back to Egypt to serve in the garbage village. We did not know about garbage villages when we went back to Egypt. I went back to Egypt from Canada to work among students with IFES. And we'll tell you later how Rebecca got involved in the garbage village. But looking over that place over 28 years, we can see what God has done. So one of the advantages of an older person sharing with you is I can share with you God's work over a long period of time. It's great to be here, but it's surprising. You see, I was not programmed to be a Bible teacher. Now you're surprised by that. What does it mean? My grandfather, my mother's father, was one of the richest men in Egypt. He was a big industrialist. He owned many varied businesses and would sell and buy businesses at will. He had the misfortune of having three daughters who were not interested in his business. And so when his eldest daughter, my mother, had a baby boy, he grabbed onto me. My poor father, who was a famous dentist, had no chance. My grandfather programmed me from the time I was born to be the heir to his industrial empire. I remember at 5 years old being dragged along to his factories to see the business. He started his first business at 13, so he probably thought I could start mine at 5. But I knew, I had no identity crisis. I knew clearly that one day I would be taking over Grandpa's businesses, and that's what I was programmed for as a teenager and most of my young life. But then the bottom crashed. The Egyptian government decided to nationalize businesses, and my grandfather heard that his business was going to be nationalized. That is, the government would take it over and give you a salary of $200 a month to run your own business. So he escaped before that happened. And a few years later, I was smuggled out of Egypt to go and live with him in Canada. A few months after I moved to Canada, to Montreal, to live with my grandparents, my grandfather died. And my grandmother left for Lebanon. And I was left as a 16-year-old student all alone in Montreal with his bankrupt companies to fold up and the bank demanding money for them, and me completely at a loss. Through the love of a local church, Rosemount Bible Church, and I think there's some people from Rosemount here. Wherever Rosemount is, good. The young people in that church reached out to me as a young foreign student in Montreal, all alone, and not knowing what the future held. My parents were stuck in Europe. They'd escaped Egypt, but the Canadian government wouldn't let them in. We were in a situation similar but not as extreme as what you'll be hearing tonight from Ruth Padilla, as she shares about people who are migrants, people who are forced to move. And we were in that situation, and the future was dim. We didn't know what would happen. And young people reached out to me. Now, what do I remember 47 years ago from how these people witnessed to me? Because we talked about this morning, and we did this Twitter exercise. I remember two things. I remember Bob Ireland taking me to the bus after a young people's meeting and explaining to me that I did not have to buy a new ticket every time I got on a bus in Montreal. But there were things called transfers that would allow me to do my whole bus trip on one ticket. That's 47 years ago. I still remember that helpful advice that saved me a lot of money. And I remember Helen McWilliam, who, when she heard I wanted to learn how to type, said, "I have a typing book." And next week, she came to Young People's with a book that she loaned to me to teach me how to type. Now, why do I remember these things? Because as a foreign student, it made a big difference to me that people cared for me, that people reached out to me, that people went out of their way to help me. I also remember that though I came from a nominally Christian background, that church had very clear Bible teaching. And that summer, I committed my life to Jesus Christ, and my life was changed. And God reprogrammed me, and that's why I'm here today. Now, as we were preparing for this and these Twitter messages, Lindsay Olsberg, who's been helping me get ready and was coordinating all the Bible studies here, said, "Why don't you share a story of you doing personal evangelism?" Well, you know, when you're a Christian leader in a Christian organization and you're older like me, you don't get that many chances. And I said, "Well, what's a good story I can share?" And just after that, I was visiting my grandchildren. We have two lovely grandchildren, a 2.5-year-old boy and a 6-month-year-old daughter, and granddaughter, and I miss them terribly being here. And I was visiting them at my daughter's home, and she had a friend. We call the friend Susie. And as soon as I came in, my daughter Layla said, "Daddy, I want you to talk to Susie about God." Well, I was more interested in my grandchildren than Susie, and I used the excuse that I had to play with the grandchildren. But when the grandchildren were in bed, Layla got to me again. He said, "Now, Daddy, you have no excuse. Speak to Susie." I did not want to speak to Susie. And many of my feelings were very similar to what you tweeted today. What do I have to say to Susie? She's much younger. She's from a different culture. What would I tell her? How can I speak to her? You know, maybe she'd turn me down. Maybe she'd get offended. You know, I told you yesterday, I'm a social worker. I hate offending people. My makeup is to make people feel comfortable and happy. Well, I knew I had to do something. And somehow I started saying something to Susie. And God opened up the opportunity. And it was a wonderful time of sharing the gospel with Susie. All I want to tell you is, I don't think you'll ever become slick professional witnesses. Some people maybe automatically are that way, but most of us are not. It's always going to be an effort. And it's even now an effort for me. But it's out of a conviction of what we talked about yesterday, of this amazing message of God's love that we want to share with people. Now, today we're talking about Nathanael, and in this morning's Bible study, you read how Jesus found Andrew. Well, I'll get back to that in a minute. I'll read you the story from Nathanael, from John chapter 1, verses 43 to 46. And then we go on. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Now we saw that skit about it. "Nazareth," Nathanael said, "can anything good come out of there?" "Come and see," said Philip. So Jesus finds Andrew. Andrew finds Peter, his brother. Jesus finds Philip. And Philip finds Nathanael, his friend. That's what evangelism is all about. Reaching out to family and friends. Relationship evangelism is ideal. Reach out first to your family and friends. Now, like other people in the Gospel of John, Nathanael, in his encounter with Jesus, went through various steps. We'll see this with Nicodemus, with a Samaritan woman, with a man born blind, and other characters in the book of John. We have several steps. Now, I want to share with you the five steps I believe Nathanael went through, the five different moods or attitudes he had. At first, he was skeptical. Then he became willing. Then he was startled. And then he felt exposed. And finally, he was totally convinced. Let's look at each of these briefly this morning. First, he was skeptical. He doubted Philip's assertion about Jesus. How can Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph, be the expected Messiah? Can any good come out of this? He's skeptical, he's sarcastic. And all of us have in our cultures places where we don't think any good can come out of them. But much of the world today has the same attitude. They're skeptical and they're sarcastic. And this is one of our greatest challenges. So Nathanael represents people we meet daily on our campuses who do not even think it's worth taking the time to consider Jesus. But then when there was an insistence from Philip, when Philip said, "I can't convince you, but come and see. Come and see Jesus. Come to him." And when Philip did this, surprisingly, Nathanael had enough religious or spiritual interest to be willing. And as a God-fearing man, he was willing to examine Philip's find. I want to tell you the story of an Egyptian carpenter. His name was Athanasius, and we're talking about the middle of the 19th century, around 1850. He listened to a young man about half his age, Athanasius about 40, and John Hogg was about 25. John Hogg was a very tall Scottish missionary to Egypt. He was part of what was then called the Student Volunteer Movement, a group of people who had a vision to evangelize the world in this generation. And like you, had a burden to reach out with the gospel to different places. They came to Egypt, these young missionaries, and they bought a boat and they went down south where the majority of Christians were found, and they settled in a place called Asyut and they began evangelizing. Athanasius was a deacon in the established church in Egypt, and he was interested in Christian things and open. The missionaries had a Bible study in his home, and he began to realize that there were things he had not known and had not heard, and he began to come alive in Christ through that Bible study. The vision of his missionaries was to renew, to revive the ancient Egyptian church that had been going on since the time when Mark, the writer of the gospel, had founded the church in Egypt. But like all renewal movements, they were rejected. And they had to establish their own little evangelical church in Asyut, and Athanasius became one of the first elders of the first evangelical church in Asyut. He was a carpenter, and he became a tent maker. He actually didn't make tents, he made water wheels. You know, there are these things that pump water out from a lower area to a higher area to water fields. and they're driven by oxen, but they're built out of wood. And he was a builder of water wheels. It took maybe up to a month to build the water wheel. And while they had building that water wheel, Athanasius would take every opportunity at breaks to evangelize the people of a village for whom he was building a water wheel. And it's said that he established many small evangelical churches all around Asyut through building his water wheels. That was a long time ago. Let's continue our text. John goes on in verse 47. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Then Nathanael declared, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus said, "You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You will see much greater things than that." He then added, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." When Nathanael, his third emotion, he was startled. He was completely taken aback by Jesus' statements about him. Instead of him examining Jesus, he finds himself already known by Jesus. And the verdict is, here is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit. Jesus is it's a play on words. Israel is Jacob. It's the same name. It was called Jacob. And Jacob means deceiver. So here's a Jacob without deceit. But stubbornly, he challenges Jesus' ability to really know him. "How do you know me?" Now, I tried to think of an illustration, a modern illustration of this kind of approach of Jesus. And I came up with one that I'm sharing with you with great hesitancy. And the reason I'm sharing it to you with great hesitancy is it's a very remarkable story. It doesn't happen every day. The man who told it to me, and I checked with him twice to make sure it was true, said in 30 years of ministry in the Middle East, he's never heard something like this. So I'll share it with you only because it fits here as a remarkable thing that Jesus is still doing. There's a Christian worker in one of the countries in the Middle East who got a phone call one day, and the person phoning him said, "Who's this?" So our friend, we'll call him Magdi. Magdi said, "Well, I'm supposed to ask you who's this. You're not supposed to ask me. How am I supposed to know? Why do you want to know my name? How did you get my number?" The man said, "My wife is sick, and I was praying to God for her healing. And I got a vision, and a man in the vision gave me your phone number and said, if I phoned you, you would come and he'll pray for my wife and she'd be healed." Magdi was startled. He'd never heard of something like this. It took courage for him to go to that man's home and to pray for that man's wife. And the woman was healed. And the man and his wife and their family started following Jesus. Jesus is still working today. Maybe not all the time in dramatic ways, but he can use dramatic ways, as he did with Nathanael. He can prove that he can see beyond, that he can see way beyond where we are. And so the fourth experience of Nathanael was he felt very exposed. The complete change of attitude when Jesus said, "I saw you under the fig tree." Now, we don't know what Nathanael was doing under the fig tree. The fig tree, if you read in the Old Testament, was a place where people lived in safety. It says in 1 Kings, each person lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. And in Micah, it says, no one will make them afraid. That the people who sit under fig trees are people, it's a place of safety, a place of privacy. Maybe he was praying. Maybe he was confessing his sins. We don't know what he was doing. But obviously what he was doing there was so private that when Jesus said, "I saw you under the fig tree," he was amazed. His privacy had been invaded. He was completely exposed. He was transparent. He was open to Jesus. And so the transformation took place. Like this couple, when the man came and prayed for the wife and she was healed and they believed in Jesus. So Nathanael comes as a religious Jew, as a man to whom these words must have been very difficult to utter. He is so changed, he believes from the depths of his heart, he's totally convinced that Philip was right, that this is the one about whom Moses and the prophets wrote. He's seen for himself and he's believed. So he makes that very remarkable statement. You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. A remarkable declaration for a religious, pious Jew in that day and age. He's seen the truth, and it's truth in capital letters, and he confesses it. I remember when I worked with the GBU in Montreal in the 70s. These were very exciting days. I was going to tell someone that I was the director of GBU in Quebec, but I had to watch it because at first I was the only staff member and I was directing myself. But in 72, when we revived that French student ministry in Montreal, they had begun an evangelical revival in the province of Quebec. And every week we would hear of a new church group being formed in Quebec. Every week we'd hear of students accepting Jesus as their savior on campuses. My job as a staff member was to slow down their evangelism so we'd have time to disciple them. It was quite contrary to what we do now. I remember literally telling people, let's stop evangelizing. We can't cope with all the new Christians. We need to build up the Christians who are there. Et pour les GBUciens ici, je vous dis que je m'excuse de ne pas pouvoir vous parler en français, adresser en français, mais les années que j'ai passées au Québec étaient les meilleures années de ma vie, surtout avec le GBU. Vous êtes là? Okay, we have some of them here. And there's GBUs in Africa and in other places probably. These were exciting days, to see God at work, to see God reaching out to students. Students who were very secular in those days, who'd never heard the gospel and being transformed. We're seeing a similar, though not identical, response in the Middle East through satellite television. As satellite television has broken the barriers of censorship and reached into homes, the gospel now is being proclaimed in nearly every home in the Middle East, crossing all the barriers and all the censorship, and we see Jesus lifted up and people accepting him as Lord and Savior. So he's totally convinced, Nathanael is. He's gone through all these steps. But Jesus promises Nathanael that in the journey of faith, the best is yet to come. Jesus says, truly, truly, or verily, verily, I say to you. And he says, all who are here, when we all here is plural in this text, will see greater things than this remarkable unveiling of Nathanael's life. And he says that he will see the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. The image is that of Jacob. When Jacob woke up from his dream, I'm reading in Genesis 28, 16, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is the place. This is none other than the house of God, which is Bethel, the altar he built. This is the gate of heaven. And the Jews knew that quote, and Nathanael knew what Jesus meant about the angels descending and ascending on the gate to heaven, on Bethel. Instead of the angels descending on Bethel, the house of God, Jesus was declaring that the angels now will descend and ascend on Jesus, the incarnation of God on earth. This is where God is, in Jesus. And angels will descend and ascend on him. He is the place where God is. So what's our conclusion from this morning's Bible study with Andrew reaching out to Peter and Philip reaching out to Nathanael? We need to all seek the willing, be they seekers or skeptics. We need to seek anybody who is willing to listen. There are many people like Nathanael around us whom God may be preparing for us to bring to Jesus. We need to be obedient like Philip and keep the eyes of our faith open to the unlikely people around us whom God may want to touch. Trust Jesus to work in their lives. He specializes in surprising people once they truly seek him. Nathanael, Susie, Athanasius, the friend whose name you wrote on your hand last night when Jim Tebbe challenged you to do that. Our mission is to take Jesus with us into our neighborhood, to our friends, family, and acquaintances. We are God's chosen means. The scriptures preserve, or the Bible preserve, God's clear message. And Jesus and his disciples provide the model. Go and make known the one who knows you. Amen.